Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. Each week, we explore the beliefs shaping our world. I'm your host, Umbreen Khan. Four days after the 2020 presidential election, news organizations called the race, and hundreds of thousands streamed into the streets in impromptu rallies and parades across the country. And a defiant President Trump refused to concede, making instead a series of false claims and allegations. His refusal to cooperate and challenge has translated into actions, some surprising. A series of resignations at the Department of Justice, the firing of Defense Secretary Mike Esper, and then the quiet actions from an obscure agency that has a big impact on a peaceful transition. General Services Agency Director Emily Murphy is refusing to sign the transition letter. That matters because it is needed to formally allow for resources and coordination between President-elect Joe Biden's transition team and the Trump administration. And this has many concerned. Now leaders are issuing a new statement 1 week after the election, calling for a peaceful transition. The statement reads in part, quote, "It is time to move beyond a season of partisanship and now focus on our shared future as a nation." It also goes on to say that, quote, "We pray that our leaders will listen and speak to all Americans, including those who feel they have been left out or unheard." The call for common prayer is also being echoed by one of President Trump's most loyal evangelical supporters, Dallas-based pastor Reverend Robert Jeffers. In an op-ed to Fox News on November 11th, Jeffers acknowledges the defeat of President Trump is, quote, "a bitter pill for Christians to swallow." He went on to argue that, quote, "when Joe Biden becomes president, we should commend him for the things he does right, we should condemn him the things he does wrong, and above all, we must pray fervently for our president." Now, over the coming weeks, we are going to explore that question of how we move forward. But we first need to understand where we are today and what we learned on Election Day. We know we are divided, but where are the divides? What are the issues that bring us together and the issues where we are furthest apart? To answer that question, I spoke with Public Religion Research Institute founder and president, Robert P. Jones. Anybody who is listening to this conversation that wants to think all religious people are X and everyone who doesn't embrace a particular religious tradition is Y, what would you say to them, Robbie?
I really do think the cleavages, you know, that we're seeing in the country, they do involve religion, but I think not in any kind of simplistic way. You know, I think in past generations, you might talk about a great Protestant-Catholic split. That's not what we see in the data today. You might have even talked about a kind of religious-secular split. There is some of that, but that's really not the primary cleavage. The primary cleavage, when we're talking about politics, is really white Christian groups and everyone else. And within those white Christian groups, there are some differences. White evangelical Protestants stand out as kind of a group really in their own space. And then there's some daylight between that group and the other two main groups of white Christians that are white mainline Protestant Christians and white Catholics. And then there's a big gap between them and essentially Christians of color, Americans who practice other religious traditions, and particularly those who practice none, the religiously unaffiliated.
When it comes to issues, the issue distinctions, what did you find?
Let's talk about priorities first and just kind of what people think are important. And again, this was just a few weeks ahead of the election. And when we asked people what issues they thought were critical issues to them, like white evangelicals, as I said, are in many ways kind of an island unto themselves in the American religious landscape. One thing that all religious groups shared in this environment was a concern about the fairness of presidential elections. But notable for white evangelical Protestants, the other things that were majority were abortion and terrorism and crime. Abortion showed up on no other religious group's list, going to be really clear about that. And it was the highest scoring critical issue among white evangelicals. And then these other things, terrorism and crime, they share with Republicans. One way of understanding those things is they are really external threat kinds of issues. We saw Arm using this term a little less this election cycle, but in the last election cycle, he used this term radical Islamic terrorism over and over and over again to associate violence with Islam.
I want to get a little bit more precise about a couple things here. When we've been talking a lot about terrorism in our public discourse right now, and domestic terrorism, and the face of domestic terrorism are not people who, frankly, look like me, right?
Yes. So in the survey, we do not define terrorism. So people are bringing their own presuppositions. But I can tell you from other questions we asked around this, white evangelical Protestants do not have in mind Dylann Roof and Charleston or people who look like me when they are thinking about terrorism. It's very clear that they see this as an external threat. They're the group that have the most negative views of Islam. To your bigger point, I think it's exactly right that, you know, and I could connect this to the other question, that you know, one of the things that really pushed me to write the last book was Dylann Roof, who was an evangelical Lutheran white Christian and committed this horrific act of domestic terrorism. The fact that we as a society did not, outside of a few small circles, talk about him as a radical Christian extremist, as a white Christian terrorist, I think says a lot about the kind of bias in our own language. I mean, even in some recent surveys, we've asked people when somebody, for example, commits an act of terror in the name of Christianity, are they really Christian or not? And most white Christians will say no to that question. But when we ask when someone commits violence in the name of Islam, are they really Muslim or not? And most white Christians will say yes. So there's a clear double standard here that I think is vitally important that we get our heads around, because you're right. I mean, the FBI, our own official government reports are telling us that the biggest threat of violence are from right-wing white militia groups, and many of these are deeply connected to Christianity.
Let's dial back to the American Values Survey for a moment. Let's talk about Black Protestants. What did you see as the number one issue?
It's the pandemic and racial inequality, right? They're right there together. 79% say the coronavirus pandemic, 76% say racial inequality. Coronavirus pandemic, in fact, makes everyone's list, every other religious group's list, in the top three other than white evangelical Protestants. I think that's also notable as well. And I think that has to do with their connection and support for President Trump and his downplaying of the virus. The other thing I'd say here, you know, is I'm often just stunned when I look at white evangelical Protestants and African-American Protestants. I mean, these are groups that share a lot of theology, a lot of hymns, a lot of church practices and liturgy, share a geographic kind of anchor in the South, and yet could not be more different in political space. And I think we're so accustomed to seeing that, that it's hard for us to kind of wrap our heads around that as a testimony to the continued legacy of white supremacy in the country and racial bias. One of the things I've been trying to do is just kind of hold this up. When we sort voting patterns or even patterns on a whole range of issues, particularly anything around systemic racism, there are no groups that are further apart than white evangelical Protestants and African-American Protestants. And I think putting this question back to white Christians and saying this should be really a theological scandal that we see this kind of distance between ourselves and our African-American brothers and sisters, and not something to be just taken for granted and blown past. I mean, I think we've seen it for so long, it looks fairly common, but it's absolutely striking, the distance there between these two groups.
Let me ask you a question about something we haven't talked about, which is the age representation of these groups.
So what we're seeing, generally speaking, is that white Christian groups of all kinds, so that's white evangelicals plus white Catholics plus white mainline Protestants, over the last couple of decades are all shrinking. White evangelicals, for example, are now 15% of the population. And what we're seeing is that as they're shrinking, they're also aging. And part of this is because of lower birth rates, but it's really been accelerated by younger people leaving. For example, today among white evangelical Protestants, only 9% of them are under the age of 30.
I just want to sit with that for a second, because I think we Yep. spend a lot of time in our public discourse focusing on white evangelical Protestants. You're focusing so much on 15% when there is this enormous, diverse religious landscape out there. So what do you say when do you hear that? Do you get the pushback that I got from my son recently?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's remarkable, really. One of the reasons why I think this is why they continue to receive so much attention is because of how lopsided their support is on one side of our partisan divide. So it's a group that's now down to 15% of the population, but it is more than one third of Republicans. And that's because they're just so lopsidedly supportive. I mean, in, you know, this last election, they voted somewhere between 76 and 81% again for Donald Trump. They voted 81% in 2016 for Trump, and that's about where they support Republican candidates up and down the ticket. So when you have a two-party system and you've got a group that's small, but as it's, even though it's small, it has double its influence because it's all on one side of the partisan divide supporting Republican candidates. So one party really has to pay attention to them as more than a third of its base. In 2008, for example, they were 21% of the population. Today, they're 15. But they continue to also turn out and be organized and turn out to vote. They're still a quarter of voters.
Right.
So they're overrepresented at the ballot box and they're overrepresented in the Republican Party. And I think it's because of those two things that really give them their outsized power. And while we talk about them more than we talk about white mainline Protestants, who are a kind of 60-40 split Republican to Democrat rather than an 80-20 split.
Let's pivot here from your voter survey to exit polling. When you looked at the exit polling, and this is in the midst of a pandemic, this is in the midst of some economic uncertainty, Congress was unable to pass another relief act. There are questions about health care. There are questions about our standing in the world. There are so many significant political questions that have been debated and discussed in the lead up to this election. When you looked at the exit pollings, what surprised you?
If I'm surprised, given all of that, it is how much stayed the same. None of the events of Trump's entire presidency have really moved white Christians in hugely significant ways there. And in these states too, in Georgia and Texas and North Carolina, all those kind of Sunbelt states that are becoming increasingly competitive, the only thing holding them competitive for Trump are white evangelical Protestants. In those Southern states, they voted 85%. For Trump. And in the Southern states, they make up about a third of voters instead of a quarter of voters. So they're a bigger proportion, but they're the only thing anchoring Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, Florida, even really from being solidly Democratic states.
What is not a critical issue on any of the things that I've seen is politicians telling the truth, elected leaders telling the truth. And that is something that may sound kind of odd, but again, I was in conversation with my son who said, religious people don't seem to value people who tell the truth. Explain that. And I couldn't. Help me out, Robbie. Help me out.
Oh, I know. No. I mean, the sort of things I've had to explain to my 10-year-old son, I think, in this election cycle are right. I understand exactly what you're talking about. You know, it's one of the, I think, more, I guess, disturbing questions that we saw is this question about how much a candidate's character matters to folks. And so we asked a question, first time we asked it was actually 2011, about whether a candidate who commits an immoral act in their personal life can still behave ethically and fulfill their duties in their public life. So it's not exactly a truth telling, but it is about kind of moral character. We found an initial poll that only 30% of white evangelicals said that this was possible. We asked it again in 2020, and it showed that number had moved to 7 in 10 saying that this was possible now. And then the other thing I'd say on trust is that one of the things that I think Trump has done, particularly in the coronavirus pandemic, is to really muddy the waters so that people don't know who to trust, even about something as basic as where can we get basic information about this pandemic. We asked about 8 different sources of trusted information. The top one in the country was Dr. Anthony Fauci. But even there, only 51% of Americans said that they thought they could trust him a lot. And it went down from there. Donald Trump was only at 14% of Americans saying they thought they could trust him. But I think one of the effects of this administration has been, I think the fact checkers are still trying their best to keep up. But I mean, I've seen many of them literally just say, we can't possibly fact check the falsehoods that we've heard in this last 30-minute speech, but let's kind of give you the top 20. I think the effect of that has been that there is this sense that trust is a rare commodity, I think, and particularly trust in public officials and our public institutions.
That did show up in the top 3 issues is fairness of presidential elections.
Yeah, right.
And that so too, when yeah. I read fairness of presidential elections, it to me is adjacent to trust in the electoral system and trust in the leadership. How do you square that priority and concern as a critical issue with where we are right now as we're having this conversation, as you see the president refusing to concede?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, it's notable that, you know, most Americans saw this coming. 55%, not at all confident that President Trump will concede defeat if Biden's declared the winner of the election. And in a supplemental survey we did, we found also that 77% of the country was at least somewhat worried there would not be a peaceful transition of power. What I think is going on is important for us to all remember. President Trump certainly is not going anywhere. He's already talking about running again in 2024. So I think that's part of what it is. People are hedging their bets, thinking that just because Trump's been defeated doesn't mean he's going away.
When we talked in 2018, you really underscored this point, which is party identity has become the defining way in how we think about ourselves relative to our communities, our families, our elected leadership, our civic leadership, and how we see dividing lines even erupt in the families. We are now 2 years since that conversation. Have we gotten better, or are we worse, or are we the same?
Well, we certainly haven't gotten better. I think that the thing I would kind of append to that is that what's gotten grafted on to this negative partisanship, and I should say that too, I mean, typically what we see, it's more the power of negative partisanship than positive partisanship. That is to say, it's more about me hating the other political party than me loving my own political party. That's the dynamic that we tend to see. And part of the reason why that is so powerful is because racial and religious identity have become grafted onto partisanship. I certainly don't have any answers for how we sort of undo this. Parties have been built this way over the last 50 years, and I think undoing it is, it's going to take a while.
The story that is told is about a future that is younger, it's more multi-ethnic, and it's one in which younger people tend to have relationships. They have relationships with people who are different from them when it comes to race and religion. It's a message I've been hearing for years. I'm starting to get a little skeptical, though, I have to tell you. It's one thing to talk meta about the whole country, but when I drill down and look at regions of the country, I'm not so convinced that those assumptions about, as we move forward, these divides will lessen.
I've never sort of been in the demographics as destiny camp. In one place I would say that kind of supports this caveat, you know, you're making is as looking at the younger white vote in the exit polls. And that may be what you're referring to, but
it
what's
is,
notable
for
there.
Our listeners, because we're on Zoom right now, can't see. I'm shaking my head. Yes. That's exactly what I was looking at. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, but if you look at the under 30 vote, it's remarkable. If you look at African-American, Latino, AAPI folks, I mean, overwhelmingly rejected Trump and voted for Biden. But whites under the age of 30 are basically divided. You know, 45% of them in one exit poll voted for Trump. And in the other exit poll, it's 51% of whites under the age of 30. Right. So at best, they're a divided constituency over Trump. If Trump put anything on the ballot, I think, for this younger generation, it's immigration and racial justice issues. In some ways, this being a referendum on that, whites under the age of 30 did not give a resounding answer to where they are on those questions. When I look at the future and, you know, this talk about healing the wounds of the nation, you know, or to take Lincoln's binding up the wounds of the nation after the Civil War, what's going to really make that tough is that it's not just it is partisanship, but partisanship has become connected so intimately with racial and religious identity. And so that, for example, you know, we have a Republican Party today that is more than two-thirds white and Christian. It's a very homogeneous party that looks very different than the rest of the country. And the Democratic Party is only about a third white and Christian and maps more closely to the demographics of the country. But that's not a recipe for a healthy democracy.
Robert P. Jones is the founder and CEO of PRRI, Public Religion Research Institute, and he's the author of White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Coming up, how the absence of representation in children's books inspired a collaboration between two moms and authors, one Jewish and one Muslim. Together, they wrote a young adult story that explores the complicated and universal themes of coming of age, living in a bicultural home, and what it means to be an American. You are listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. Stay with us. Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska, and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. I'm Umbreen Khan, and this is Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. We're going to turn now to middle school. Personally, not a time I like to dwell on, especially sixth grade. It was the worst. I would retreat into Judy Blume books. I had my nose down inside those pages, and I loved learning and meeting all the various characters that would appear. Their struggles were sometimes universal, sometimes not. It was in many ways an introduction for me, especially as an immigrant, to families that were different from mine, and I appreciated that. Now, I will say sometimes I did feel outside, like on the outside, literally reading those books. There were never any characters that represented the struggles that I was going through that were unique to me and to my experience. Turns out that desire to be represented can be a powerful motivation for a writer.
There was just an urge from me to want to write the book that I would have wanted to read as a kid, with a modern day, a contemporary kid who's in an interfaith family from a bicultural experience, and explore that. But at the same time, part of me realized maybe that's not a story that I can tell by myself. Maybe this is a story for two people to tell, to give a broader view of what that experience is like.
Laura Chavon did just that. 2 years ago, she met Sadia Farooqi, a Pakistani-American interfaith activist and children's writer from Texas. The two had entered a writing contest, and although Sadia didn't win, she did get to meet Laura.
Laura was one of the mentors that year, and she agreed to kind of unofficially help me improve my manuscript at that time. And that's how I got to know her, just her generosity and willingness to help somebody who was just starting out.
The collaboration turned into a friendship and a book, A Place at the Table. In this story, Elizabeth, a first-generation Jewish American, and Sara, a first-generation Pakistani American, meet in an after-school cooking class and become unlikely friends. They don't hit it off at first, but then they discover both their mothers are applying for U.S. citizenship, and the two form a shaky alliance and even make plans to win a spot on a local food show. And it's here, in trying to concoct the most amazing cross-cultural dish, they test their skills and their friendship. This story weaves so many themes: food, family, and the lived experience of being a person of faith. For both women, this project was personal.
I'm an immigrant to the U.S., and it was a long time ago, but it's been a long road to feeling as part of the country, obviously, as every immigrant does. And so I really identify more with Mrs. Hamid, Sara's mother. But then my kids are first generation Americans. They're born here. They're growing up here. So everything that Sara feels in the book is things that I have seen both my kids, my daughter and my son, go through.
I had always wanted to write a story very loosely based on my own life growing up. My mother is an immigrant from England. She moved here in, I think, 1967. That's right. And married my father, who was a New Yorker from the Bronx and Jewish, and she converted when she moved here. And we lived in a very multicultural family, but it was a struggle in many ways. I felt growing up very connected to my British culture because we traveled quite often to see my grandparents. And yet when we were in England, my brothers and I were kind of an oddity for having brown eyes, and we were called Yanks. So we felt very connected to that, but also very much other than that. And yet in America, we also, you know, being so connected to our mom's culture, that was a struggle. You know, Hebrew school was an odd place for us because we were being raised mainly by a parent who was a convert and who wasn't as connected with Jewish culture as, you know, someone who was born into it.
Are you concerned that this may not appeal to kids who are not first-generation immigrants?
I feel like part of it is the universal story of starting middle school and having this bigger pool of kids and having to sort of renegotiate the friendships. You know, are my friendships from elementary school going to continue in the same way when I get to sixth grade? Well, no, they're not. But am I going to retain them, I guess, is the question. And then for Sarah's character, there's the additional level of being at a large public middle school for the first time. That shift from elementary to middle school is a time when kids are stepping outside of that kind of close-knit elementary school experience. And for many kids, it's a time when they're starting to see and establish who they are beyond their family, beyond their close-knit circle.
Why is food so central and important in this book?
Oh my gosh, so much about human nature. And one of the key things that I've learned in the last 20 years is that food really brings people together from very different perspectives or life experiences or religions. It's something that you can bond over. It's something that you can learn from. We have little kind of, you know, bits in the book throughout where Sarah's mom in the cooking club is cooking, say, a samosa. And Elizabeth says, oh, this is like something we cook in the Jewish culture as well. So there's so much that can bring us together over food, over a table of food. You know, things that I've seen a lot of times my kids shy away from because it makes them feel different from their classmates or their friends. There's so much that a lot of first generation kids kind of feel that they need to hide because it makes them feel different or look different. And this is our way of saying it's really not. It's something that can bring you closer together.
It was Sadia's idea to bring in the food element. And it was really interesting to me because I learned from Sadia that a lot of women in particular who are immigrants have to bring and rely on their soft skills when they come to this country because their degrees or their certifications, their professional background might not transfer over. So that was one reason. But as we developed the characters for me, for Elizabeth, the food is very symbolic. She is missing that that sense of nurturing from her mother, who's going through this depression, from her father, who travels quite a bit for work. And for her, being in the kitchen is symbolic of that family togetherness that she's missing so much. So she sort of gloms on to the Hamid family because for her, they represent that closeness that comes when we're cooking together in the kitchen.
Mm. And it's interesting because for Sarah, it's the complete opposite. The story actually starts out, the first line is, cooking is painful. For her, she's sick and tired of this cooking and this food because she wants something more American, and she sees her own food as something that makes her stand out even more. She's trying not to stand out. She's trying to be American, but her family, and especially her mom, just insist on being very outspoken in their jobs. Her mom's a caterer and now is teaching a cooking class in her school. How embarrassing is that, about this other kind of food? And so she wants to do everything to get away from it. You know, things that I've seen a lot of times my kids shy away from because it makes them feel different from their classmates or their friends. There's so much that a lot of first generation kids kind of feel that they need to hide because it makes them feel different or look different. And this is our way of saying it's really not. It's something that can bring you closer together.
There are scenes that don't shy away from bias and prejudice. Did either of you have any concerns or encounter any pushback as you were writing this?
Sadia and I have been talking about this lately. An issue was raised about the scene where somebody calls Elizabeth's mother a shiksa, which is, I guess you could say it's a derogatory. It's not a nice thing to say. It's a term for a woman who's not Jewish, which, by the way, she is. And I think it's really interesting that there was a little bit of pushback on that, you know, from a perspective of somebody Jewish saying, do we really want to share that? And I had to say, and, you know, Sadia and our editor backed me up, that kids hear these things. They hear adults using these terms. That's how kids learn them. And I think it's important to have them in books because then kids have seen, what do I do when that happens?
Another thing that we really wanted to bring to the story was how to be an ally, how to be a real friend, which means not just be a friend in terms of, you know, hanging out together, going to the mall together, or talking about stuff that you have in common, but really standing up to others, people who might say something negative or feel not in the best way towards your friend. So we actually have scenes in the book where Sarah has to sit with Elizabeth and explain, hey, this happened and you just stood there. You were quiet. I need something else from you. I need you to stand up for me. Being a friend means standing up for someone. So really modeling, not just for our kid readers, but also our adult readers, what an ally is, how to be an ally, which means not just stand there when you see a microaggression or a full-blown incident, but really be able to stand up for that person, whether it's your friend or a stranger, and say, this is not okay.
Can you give me an example from the book?
It's just such a simple thing. It's just a saying that Elizabeth says, sugar and spice. And I'm sugar because I like to bake, and you're spice because, she doesn't say it, but because in her mind, Sarah cooks, her family cooks with a lot of spices. And, you know, she's 11. She's a young girl, and nobody's ever had her stop and think through how that might be perceived as offensive by somebody else.
I'm curious, Sadia, do you feel like if someone said, I'm sugar, you're the spice, would that feel like a microaggression to you?
So definitely depends on, you know, who you are and whether you've had experiences. So much about microaggressions, I believe, is what your own life experience has been like. There are so many other instances in the book that are like that. For example, Maddie, who's Elizabeth's friend, keeps saying PLU, people like us. It's just, you know, why would you say that?
I think the word normal really takes on a different meaning in this book. I think Elizabeth starts to realize that her friend Maddie is using the word normal to communicate dominant culture. And Elizabeth is just starting to realize, oh, that's what's going on. That's what she means when she says normal. And I'm not okay with that because, you know, she's saying that I'm okay even though I'm Jewish. Wait a second. That's not how a friend should behave.
In each chapter, Sarah and Elizabeth work through their various issues, but you introduce conflicts and struggles of their parents. Elizabeth's mom is struggling with depression, Sarah's mom with financial stress. Why did you include, or why rather was it important for you to include those in a middle grade novel?
My mom struggled with a lot of depression and social anxiety, which was just exacerbated by being an immigrant. And, you know, when I hear from adults that they're connecting with the mother characters, both of the mother characters, that's really important to me because, you know, it was in a way an opportunity to rewrite some of what my mom experienced. And Sadia and I have talked about, you know, so many middle grade stories, they joke about like the parents are either dead or the kids have somehow left the parents behind. And it was really important to us to have kids in this book who are in intact families where they have, although they struggle with their relationship with their parents, they have a strong relationship with their parents.
The way I wrote it, or we wrote it, but the way especially I wanted to bring Sarah's parents' characters to life is having that showcase of the immigrant experience, in particular, as it relates to adults as well, because it would be only half a story if it was only Sarah's story or Elizabeth's story. Their story as first-generation kids is in part because of their parents' experiences as immigrants, as somebody who's other, as somebody who's struggling with whatever they're struggling, in the case of Elizabeth's mom, depression, in the case of Sarah's family, financial difficulties that come from moving your entire family and living somewhere else and not being able to use your degree and not being able to get the job that you had in the country that you were born in. And all those things are what informs the children's story. So if we had not put that in and missed that, that would have been a very, I think, a disservice to our readers and to the story itself.
You touch on a lot of third rails, race, religion, bias, but not politics. I'm curious, why is that not a bigger part of the story?
There's an election day scene where both of the girls have gone with their fathers, who are both citizens, to vote. And there's some conversation in that scene about a conservative candidate and that candidate who is an incumbent in the local election who hasn't been doing enough to address anti-Semitism that's happening where the girls live. So I feel like we addressed it in that way, but the politics, I feel personally, like for the age that they are, they're just beginning to be aware of the larger context outside of their families. Interestingly, one of the things we did in writing the book, we created a chapter by chapter outline from Maddie's point of view so we could really look at how she changes over the course of the book. And I think between or among the kid characters, the 11-year-olds in the story, that political piece where a kid is starting to think about how do I feel and how have I been told to feel and how are those two things different? Maddie's the one who experiences that the most.
Mm. Who did you write this for?
First and foremost, I wrote this book for my kids. Also, I would have liked to have a book like this when I was a new immigrant. And so I think that for me, it was definitely both the kids and especially the moms. The moms are huge characters in these books, equal to the kids, which is kind of not very common in children's books.
It's interesting that you mentioned, Sadia, about kids doing everything in novels, because one of the pieces of feedback that I got from people I interviewed for the book was that for immigrant families, very often the kids are doing a lot of things, as you know, for their parents, because the first generation child can navigate American culture so much better than their immigrant parent can. So, you know, like I talked to a woman whose family came from Korea, and she described helping her parents fill out tax forms because it was something that they couldn't navigate. So I think part of the immigrant story and part of our story is the ways that first generation kids, I don't want to say that they parent the parents, but they're kind of a liaison almost to American culture for their parents. And it puts them in a very different role. So for me, the readership is those kids, like the kids like I was, who are bicultural, who are American, yet have this very strong connection to their family's culture of origin. And what that experience is like, when I was growing up, there weren't books like that. They just really didn't exist. These friendships between kids who are navigating what it means to be American, what it means to be first generation American, and all of the sort of the added stuff that comes along with that.
There are a lot of scenes for both Sarah and Elizabeth heading to their respective houses of worship, synagogue, mosque, Hebrew school, Sunday school, Muslim Sunday school, rather. I am curious, why was it so important for you to have so many of those kind of smaller moments?
The fact that they're both from marginalized faith communities is a point of connection instead of a point of conflict between them.
I want our book to be a source of comfort and coming together for people. And that's how we approached it. I think that was just so important for me, and you know, just turned out that for this book, it was a perfect way to showcase that. There's a scene when Elizabeth comes to Sarah's house for the first time, and she opens the front door, and in the hallway, there's a picture, you know, which you will see in so many Muslim houses, It's basically calligraphy. It's like, you know, something written in Arabic, maybe a verse from the Quran. And so many Muslim houses have something like that on their walls. And it would be very different, strange, unusual, especially in the time that we're at, maybe suspicious. But Elizabeth looks at it and she says, oh, I have something similar in my house too. My parents' marriage contract is similar. It just kind of like gives me the same vibe or feeling. And we put that in very deliberately because we wanted our readers, whether they're kids or adults, to be able to identify things that you might think are different, but maybe in a way they remind you of something else that's similar for you. And that is the way that we work together with people who we think are so different. Find something, whether it's food or art or anything really, that you can find a commonality.
You really wanted the characters to be believable. You didn't want that to throw off the reader. You know, people are flawed. What was one of the biggest flaws that Elizabeth and Sarah grappled with?
I think for Elizabeth, her biggest flaw, which she doesn't realize she has until later in the story, is she's very impulsive, and that impulsivity gets the girls in trouble. And when she gets an idea in her head, she doesn't stop and think how that idea is going to affect the people around her, her mother, her friend. I just finished listening to the audiobook, and it was very interesting to listen to when they're talking about the recipe that they're creating. They talk about the fact that Sarah is a planner and Elizabeth is a doer. And that's tied into this idea that Sarah withholds a little bit more. She's more cautious, and Elizabeth is more, like I said, impulsive and needs to learn to temper that a little bit and how it impacts the people around her.
For Sarah, it was really this deep-seated kind of anger that she had in her own life because of how she saw people treating her parents. In the story, she's always been to Islamic school, so she's not been in this environment where people have been mean to her because of her faith or her color or anything else up till now when the story starts. But she's seen how her parents have struggled and had things said to them and had to just be quiet and not say anything back in a lot of ways. And that's made her a very prickly, often rude character because she doesn't want to deal with people. She doesn't have a good experience of the human race. That's so, so realistic for a lot of kids.
I feel for the age group that we wrote for is the idea that friendship is complicated. So often we portray friendship between children as being an easy thing. And, you know, either somebody's your friend or they're your bully, or your friend, kind of like Maddie, who suddenly stops being your friend and you don't know why. And Sadia and I have been talking quite a bit about the idea that these girls are on the cusp of young adulthood. And this is their first experience of having a friendship that they had to work at. They had to make a decision if this new friend was important enough in their life to put effort into it. And I think Elizabeth's mother even says that to her at some point. You know, you have to make a decision if this friendship is worth putting time and effort into, if it's a friendship that you value and you think is worth your time. And our book recognizes the fact that kids are human beings and they struggle in their friendships sometimes. And to honor the idea that for some friendships are definitely worth putting the time and the effort into. It's not like I'm going to pat them on the head and say, oh, it'll all blow over by tomorrow. As the author, as a mom, it's more about recognizing the fact that this is very real for them and that they do have to work at it. And in a way, it's their first sort of not quite, but almost adult friendship as two young women.
Laura Chavon is the author of the award-winning middle grade novel, The Last Fifth Grade of Emerson Elementary. She is also a poet in the schools of Maryland. Sadia Farooqi is a Pakistani-American author, essayist, and interfaith activist. She writes the children's early reader series, Yasmin, published by Capstone. Coming up, we remember Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who passed away November 7th at the age of 72 after his battle with cancer. You are listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. Stay with us. You are listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. Earlier this week, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the United Kingdom's former chief rabbi, died of cancer at the age of 72 in London. Rabbi Sacks was an influential thought leader in the Jewish and interfaith worlds. He was a public scholar, a religious leader, and a prolific communicator. He relished the opportunity to use his platform to advocate for interfaith cooperation and the common good. Although he was a member of the Orthodox tradition, his sphere of influence extended far beyond the relatively small Jewish community in the Commonwealth, where he served as the chief rabbi from 1991 to 2013. Rabbi Sacks had a passion for engaging on big, vexing issues, but I would suggest he was a strategic idealist. He understood who he could reach and who he could not. Let's take a listen to Rabbi Sacks explaining to Maureen Fiedler, my predecessor, in an episode from 2015, why he wrote Not in God's Name, Confronting Religious Extremism.
I did not write this book to turn extremists into moderates. I wrote this book to give courage and confidence to the moderates, to remain moderates and not become extremists. And that is terribly important because right now, the voices that are the loudest and the angriest and the images that dominate the airwaves of not just television, but the social media, Facebook, YouTube, and so on, are angry and extremist and violent voices and violent images. And it's as if the moderates have been devoiced. And I wanted to say to people like Akburn, people like the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's also working for peace between faiths, let us go out there and make young people feel that if we really want to seek altruism, let's do it by bringing people together instead of driving people apart.
And of course, that's sort of the quintessence of your interfaith dialogue that you've had with folks that are Muslim or Christian or probably a dozen other faith traditions over your years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And I wanted in the book to give a sense of the drama here because, you know, if you just take the Bible, the first two human children perform the first recorded religious act. They bring an offering to God. And the end result of that is sibling rivalry and Cain kills Abel. So the Bible's very honest with us. It's telling us at the beginning, don't think religion is always peaceful. People, when they get really upset, can use religion to justify violence. And no doubt Cain was saying, God, if you didn't like my first offering, which was just a grain offering, I'm going to bring you a human sacrifice. I'm going to kill my brother. And God has to say to Cain, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. God had to protest. And so what I'm really saying is just look at this drama. Don't think religion is easy. All I need to do is have faith and everyone else have faith and we'll have peace in the world. No, it's a drama. There are the better angels of our nature and the worse angels, and sometimes we tell ourselves that God is speaking to those worst angels, and he isn't.
Indeed, morality, restoring the common good in divided times, carries some very urgent messages, particularly now for this time.
Two things, a market economy and a democratic state. That's all you need. And that has been a colossal mistake. Because if you think about it, a market economy and a democratic state are both about competition. The market economy is about competition for wealth, and the democratic state is about the competition for power. And those things are important and necessary and really, really essential. But something is missing in the emotions and the habits of the heart that constitute morality. Morality is what happens when we subordinate self-interest to the common good, where we care about others, not just ourselves. And those places are the places where we speak the emotional and practical language of we.
Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, back in April 2020, at the University of London, delivering a public lecture, arguing that we are in the midst of a cultural climate change and that we must shift from a competitive ethos to one animated by altruism and cooperation. Knighted by Queen Elizabeth II in 2005, he served as a member of the House of Lords from 2009 to his death last week at the age of 72. That's all for this week. Inspired is a production of a listener-supported media nonprofit, Interfaith Voices. If you value this program, I invite you to Interfaith Radio to learn more about us, explore the archives, subscribe to the newsletter, and support our work. A special thanks to our producer, Kevin McCarthy, MC Yogi for our theme music, and our founder, Maureen Fiedler. I'm your host, Umbreen Khan. Wherever you are, I hope you are safe, and we will see you next week.